Welcome to In the Weeds with Nicole Asquith, exploring the way culture shapes our relationship to the natural world. Hi, guys. I've been running behind schedule with episodes recently due to some family issues. I apologize for the delay and appreciate your patience. Today's episode is the first of three that will address farming from different but related perspectives. The way we grow our food has a big impact on climate and many other aspects of the health of our planet, as well as, of course, our own human health. The EPA estimates that agriculture accounts for 11% of greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S. It is said to have risen to 14% globally. And that's not even addressing the impacts of pesticides, erosion, deforestation, and so on. But some forms of agriculture can be a net positive for the climate, can support biodiversity, the health of our soils, and of course, our own health. So unlike, say, air travel, farming has this curious potential for ill and for good. Farming is also important to the podcast because it is at the origin of the concept of culture. The word culture itself was first used to refer to farming, to the cultivation of the land, or the tending of animals. That history of the word is one of the things that inspired this podcast. If you think about the fact that the turn from nomadic life to farming is really what laid the groundwork for human civilization, and that our ability to grow the food we need to survive is at the very heart of our relationship to the natural world, you start to see that the farmer's cultivation of the soil is rich with meanings and implications. In this first interview, I talked to filmmaker Jim Beckett about his new film on Vandana Shiva, the Indian environmental activist and scholar who is a powerful voice for locally based organic farming.
Food is a weapon. When you sell real weapons, you control armies. When you control food, you control society. But when you control seed, you control life on earth.
The film, called The Seeds of Vandana Shiva, has recently completed a successful festival run and will soon be available on the major streaming services. In the meantime, for excerpts and more information about the film, you can go to the website, vandanashivamovie.com. Jim Beckett has a rich professional background that he brings to his filmmaking. As a former ski racer, developmental economist, human rights lawyer, international civil servant, journalist, and author. He wrote the first Amnesty International report on torture, and as Director of Public Information for the United Nations High Commissioner of Refugees, made several films about refugee problems around the world, which he followed with other documentary films, including the award-winning Sons of Africa. He's also co-produced several documentaries on environmental issues, including The Green Patriarch, The Amazon, The End of Infinity, and The Arctic, The Consequences of Human Folly. Jim met Vandana Shiva when she attended one of a series of ship-borne colloquia on the environment hosted by the Archbishop of the Eastern Orthodox Church, Bartholomew I of Constantinople, also known as the Green Patriarch for his staunch environmentalism. Jim was instrumental in making these colloquia, which were, again took place on ships. For example, one of them went along the Amazon River, and Vandana Shiva attended one of these, and that's how Jim got to know her. For those of you who have never heard of Vandana Shiva before, I really urge you to see the film when it's available. And in the meantime, take a look at some of the excerpts that are on the website. She's so charismatic and has such a presence that to get the full effect, the video is very helpful. Here is Jim describing her.
Vandana Shiva is an Indian woman who has now reached the age of 70, I believe. And she grew up in the foothills of the Himalayas. Her father was a forest conservator. Her mother was both a farmer and a teacher. And she grew up in an environment with a very open family. I mean, she went to a Catholic school. They would go to different local gurus, and the parents were very open-minded. And her great ambition in life was to be a physicist. And in fact, when she went to the university, Saturday night, her roommates would go out partying, And she would spend time trying to solve equations, which was her idea of a good time. And so she got into nuclear physics, and she was an intern at the nuclear plant in India, which went critical and brought India into the atomic age. But then the whole incident of Hiroshima, Nagasaki, etc., she thought this was a destructive use of science, and she went away from that. And today, her name is really associated with organic agriculture. She is a big voice on climate change, and also is not enamored of industrial agriculture, and sort of the tagline is that she's Monsanto's biggest nightmare. Well, they tried changing their name. They're now Bayer. Anyway, so she is someone who has a farm in India, and she's very much into seeds and producing seeds that will be given free to farmers, again, organic seeds. And so she also, before COVID, would travel all over the world giving speeches, supporting organizations that were aligned with her particular beliefs. And with COVID, I think she's quite happily settled down on her farm. And with the miracle of the internet, she can now communicate with all sorts of groups. And her reach, which I think reaches millions, is very effective. And also, of course, she's controversial. I mean,
yes.
If you're going to attack the big corporations, whether they're oil, whether it's food, big oil, you're going to get pushback.
Yeah, we'll come around to that issue. So I like the way that the film opens. It has a cold open. You see these beautiful images of the natural world. There's a parrot perched in a tree. You see people working on the farm. And then all of a sudden, a pair of sandals and the back of a sari moving along a path, which is how we get introduced to her. And then the opening music is interrupted by the ringing of a cell phone. You see Vandana Shiva answer a cell phone. And it seemed to me like you wanted to capture sort of the duality of worlds that she inhabits, the farm world, which feels almost pre-industrial, but then the cell phone indicating, you know, the life of a global activist who flies all over the world, who connects with people on the phone and so on. So anyway, I was just curious about your choice of the opening.
You're absolutely right. Yes, that's right. We knew from the beginning that we had her two worlds. And, you know, if you're making a documentary about someone, the ideal in a way is to have a script. Right. So you can follow a script. But of course, events happen and the characters have different views about things. So the only scripted part we had was exactly that, the opening in which we see her farm, we see nature, and then this woman in flip-flops. And her cell phone rings, as you said. That was the one sort of framework we had to tell the duality of her life.
How much time were you able to spend with her for the interviews?
4 days and 53 minutes. We made at least 4 trips to India. And one of those trips, we went with her and a group of other people around various points in India. She was always very generous about sitting down and doing the interview. She is so intelligent and so quick. She's written 20 books, by the way. She's just very smart. So, you know, everything, her whole life moves very quickly. She's got no time for small talk. I mean, you don't say, hi, Vandana. What happened with the last fundraising event? Okay.
You get a real sense of her charisma and her sense of humor, too, in the film. So, you know, talking about that duality, the two worlds that she sort of inhabits, I feel like that's a theme that runs through the film. much of her critique of the industrial agro complex that controls so much of life on Earth, but not just with respect to agriculture, but globalization overall, is that its knowledge is partial, that in a sense inhabits a partial reality. So at one point in the film, she says, "I realize that a science that only teaches you to modify nature without an understanding of what that modification does to the larger world is not a complete science." She also says, "So much of science is one-sided, one-eyed, and I want knowledge in the whole." So I'm curious how you understand that part of her philosophy, because it feels really essential to what she's about to me.
Yes, and you know, so much of our culture, our academic culture, you concentrate on one narrow area. And, you know, the great minds like Einstein have been looking for a unifying concept that would bring all these elements together. And yes, she is trying to, particularly all the things that interest her, like climate change, like agriculture, etc., that this all is part of the same. You touch one element and it's going to affect the other ones. But that's one thing ecology and the environment is teaching us, and this whole holistic approach. So yes, I think you quoted those well, and I think people sort of nod with that and say, yes.
Yeah. So part of that sense of like a more holistic outlook is woven into her experience. So you talk about how she wanted to study physics, but then she's kind of pulled back into the India that she grew up in. And one example of that is her encounter with the Chipko movement, which I confess I hadn't really read about that much until seeing your film. Can you tell us about the Chipko movement?
Yes. India has a lot of what we would call indigenous people who live in the forests, who live by the sea, etc. And their livelihood depends on what nature, in particular the forests, have to offer. So enter capitalism, and in the particular case of the forests, you're talking about loggers. And so loggers would go in, cut down the trees, take away the lumber, and suddenly we just have a devastated landscape. And the indigenous people who depend on roots, on trees, the trees are what give them life. And these women are not well-placed or can lobby the Congress, whatever. So what could they do? And this is always a question at the grassroots, the forest roots. What can people who are dealing with it suffer do? So what did they do? They went and they hugged the trees. And so tree huggers, and Chipko was the word associated with these tree huggers. And there was a song that went viral in India, and it became a big thing. So hugging the trees made it pretty difficult to bring a chainsaw. And then that movement sort of caught on. And there were tree huggers in the United States, tree huggers all over defending the forests. So Vandana was a student then, and she was studying quantum physics in Canada. And she would go back every year to help the Chipko movement. She spoke English, she wrote English, so she became an effective spokesperson for the Chipko movement, and a case that was brought to the Supreme Court held that a living forest had more value than one shipment of lumber. So that was a successful story. But again, you know, she always attributes what she's learned has come from indigenous women, basically.
This sort of on the ground learned experience that gives these women a much deeper understanding of all of the different facets of the ecosystem that is then being exploited with the idea of extracting a particular resource without an understanding of the whole. Very compelling as sort of an example of that was the section that talks about what happened with the mining of limestone in the Himalaya. And she, again, turned to the local women to have a better understanding of what was actually going on.
Yes, it was limestone mining, which just left the hillsides totally scarred. And this was causing real problems with the water situation. And so there were floods that also came from deforesting, also brought floods. And the tourist bureau didn't like the idea that all of India's lovely landscape was being scarred by this. So it was another case very similar to the CHIPCO movement, where they moved it toward the Supreme Court, which held that the water table, all of that was more important. When you start to balance, it's a calculus, you know, is the limestone worth more than potable water? So that was another case that she really threw herself into. And that actually had implications because she had had a young child by then, a son, and she was getting death threats if she didn't stop her agitating and lobbying against the money people, let's put it that way. And her father told her, listen, you do what you have to do. You protect our valley. This is where you grew up. And she's often said, once your conscience is no longer your guide, if it's in terms of money, you know, forget it.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, she's, as an activist, she's, you know, you feel that you would like to study the techniques that she uses because she's very impressive in terms of the different kinds of resources that she takes advantage of, the different kinds of knowledge and sort of levers that she pulls and so on. But nowadays, and for some time, her biggest adversary is Big Ag, essentially, right?
Correct.
And as such, she is a somewhat controversial figure, but maybe we could start by just describing a little bit how she becomes aware of, first of all, GMOs and the interest that Monsanto and other players are showing in India and the implications of that as she sees it.
Yes, well, she was invited along with her sister, who is a medical doctor, to go to a meeting in Geneva. And she had been a little involved in organic agriculture, and she couldn't figure out exactly why she was invited, but she guessed it was that. So she got to this meeting that involved a lot of seed companies, fertilizer companies, the Monsantos, chemical companies, etc. And she realized, wait a minute here. They're talking about seeds and they're talking about genetically modifying. This is a future that does not look bright. So she went back to India and she started a seed saving movement. She started going to villages, which she knew from the CHIPCO movement and from the limestone situation, and she would get seeds. So she started a seed bank. You know, Gandhi and Einstein have been the two big inspirations in her life. And Gandhi, with the boycott of British cloth and the salt marsh, he took the spinning wheel as a symbol that every woman in India could do homespun cloth and forget the British. We're going to do a boycott on the British. So Vandana took the seed as the idea, the notion of free seed, the notion of the farmer as her spinning wheel, as a symbol and also a practice.
A practice of resistance. That was sort of analogous to Gandhi's promotion of the spinning wheel.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, which meant that we can boycott British cloth. Because what happened in the Indian case is India has been, for many, many years, a producer of very good cotton. And what happened, the British, as you know, took over India, and then they set up all the industrial revolution of producing cloth. So the cotton, the raw material, this is the classic case of underdevelopment. The raw material went to Britain, then through labor and machinery, its value was very much increased as cloth, and then it was exported back to the source of the cloth, India, where, you know, you had to pay many more times. So the idea was, we'll produce our own cloth, and we will not accept British cloth.
Yeah, I think that that legacy of colonialism is really essential to understanding her movement. You know, I think that without that piece, what she's doing, you don't quite get it.
Right, right.
Which makes me think, so I want to talk at greater length about the GMO piece. So full disclosure, I did an earlier episode on GMOs with Nick Kaplinski, who's a specialist in genomics, and he's the chair of biology at Swarthmore College. We talked about a book called Mendel in the Kitchen, which essentially argues that there's nothing inherently bad about the technology of GMOs itself, that it's more how they are used that's the issue. So I'm just setting that aside for a moment, just for context. But going back to the colonial legacy, she talks about three industrial revolutions: textile, chemicals, in particular pesticides, and then GMOs. So again, it seems to me that to understand her resistance to GMOs, but to big ag more broadly, you have to understand it also in that context of the ways that these technologies are used to exploit. Obviously, in the British example, for the British to exploit India, but you know, now increasingly we're talking about large corporations, right? But often still she talks a lot about the third world, the idea that like it's the poorer countries in particular that are getting the short end of the stick in this whole relationship.
Yes, and she feels that the multinationals, the globalized corporations coming in, and you know, Monsanto has dominated the Indian cotton industry with genetically modified seeds, which, according to Vandana, every year it demands more pesticides, because the GMO is not adjusting sufficiently to the bollworm, which is the disease it has, the creature it has. So Monsanto entered the picture, and they said, here is a revolutionary development. We have these new seeds that will be much more productive. Now, you'll have to buy them before the government would give you seeds.
Right.
But since this is such a superior product, so they had their salesmen go out into the villages and try to persuade people, et cetera. So, all right, we'll get the seeds. Okay, well, how are you going to pay for it? Well, I can't pay for it now because the harvest last year is over. It's done. And all right, we'll advance you the money. There are money lenders here. And the cycle of debt goes on, going through the interest rates going up, the money lender rates going up, and they have to buy the pesticide. They have to buy the seeds, fertilizers. So you have all the input elements that really weren't needed if you had the traditional seeds. So it gets so bad that Indian farmers who can't meet their payments are killing themselves. How are they killing themselves? They're drinking the pesticide. I mean, it's so Vandana estimates that, you know, some 230,000 Indian farmers have committed suicide. That figure is very disputed, but there certainly are. I mean, on our film, you know, we've got funerals and we've got the head of the village saying 18 people here have committed suicide because of the debt.
Did you film the funeral that's in the film, or did you get that?
No, we got that from a fellow filmmaker.
Okay.
An Israeli, actually, and he lives in San Francisco, and he did a long feature film, and we just took a piece of it.
A segment.
Yes, segment.
Yeah. No, that's a very intense section of the film. Obviously, the idea of, the idea of all these farmers committing suicide and committing suicide by drinking this poison that they put on the fields is intense, to put it mildly. So my sense is, to kind of break down her opposition to GMOs, my sense is that first and foremost, she's against the idea that one could patent a seed and that seeds could be kind of branded and sold as products, right?
Yes, and I think that's how India was before. And you could get seeds from your neighbor, you know. And that's what she has made a big effort to establish in India, that there would be seed banks that were constantly brought up to date in terms of what, for example, India is suffering from horrible heat now. It's also had a big monsoon. So you're growing seeds every year, and you're taking the ones that are better adapted for certain conditions. There's a famous seed bank in Svalbard in the north of Norway, where seeds from all over the world were taken and put in this vault. And Vanden has been quite against that, in the sense that she thinks that your seeds should be constantly evolving to changing atmospheric weather conditions. One thing Vanden is really brilliant at is she's a brilliant public speaker. I mean, she has you riveted. And she's known how to use communications. For example, GMO. She says, "God, move over." You know, so she has these sort of, she comes up with these bon mots that are very effective.
The counter argument to that, though, is that we have been engineering seeds pretty much since agriculture began, right? And that we have used, we have used invasive techniques before the current sort of clipping of genes that is being used, which is actually more precise than some, like the use of radiation to create genetic mutations in seeds. How would she counter that argument, do you think?
Well, speaking personally, I don't think GMOs are really the big issue. I think the issue is the agricultural system, and particularly the reliance on pesticides.
Yeah.
And Vandana is very articulate about that, what she calls the poison cartel. And these drugs were used in Vietnam. They were used in the Second World War and the Holocaust, actually these same sort of formulas. So how industrial agriculture is set up, it's depleting the soil. It's using water supplies. Industrial agriculture is causing real damage. So it's a larger global issue of how we grow our food and what the political, social, economic relation around who does it and who sells it. And Vandana has been very down on what has been called globalization.
One of the other things that she seems to oppose is this idea of a monoculture.
Absolutely right. I mean, diversity with trees and different plants and interaction, that's better for the bugs. It's better for everybody. And one thing that she particularly points out, and I'm sure that a lot of your listeners are very concerned about eating healthy food, that the nutritional value of what we're eating now is much, much less than it was, say, when I was growing up. So that this whole monoculture system is producing less nutritious food. And also 80% of it is going to feed animals. So yeah, I'm sure the science of GMOs is promising in many ways. But again, I think it's the system that has got Vandana up in arms,
right? And the ways in which these technologies are exploited, right? Which is, at the end of the day, it's the use that matters, right?
Right, right. And I mean, they are in it for profit. That's why they're doing it.
Yeah, of course. So it seems like one of the reasons she's controversial is that she's kind of on the battle lines of debates on climate change as well, right? Because climate change, you know, you already have the problem of an increasing population and the challenges of feeding that, but then you throw climate change into the mix and the stakes just go up so much more. So there's quite a debate about what the best way to adapt to climate change and to continue to feed the world's population is going to be. What would you say her vision for combating climate change is?
Well, she's certainly been on that topic very, very early, and particularly with the Himalayas right there. You know, the melting is right in that part of the world. Well, I think she, first of all, and this would surprise you, she thinks that the world can hold a larger population if we got back to a more localized farming system. I mean, if you live in the United States, you know, the family farm is a thing of the past. And Bill Gates, not a favorite of Vandana Shiva, owns more agricultural land than anybody else in the United States. So it's become a capitalist enterprise. So I think she would see going back to a more diverse agriculture, more locally based, and ending these insane things for Chilean tomatoes to be sent to my plate in California, that kind of thing.
Right, right. Yeah, and people don't really want to hear that, right? They don't want to hear that they're no longer going to have strawberries at Christmas or, yeah. So going back to that opening image of the farm and then the cell phone, how do you see where she lands on the question of technology versus going back to perhaps more traditional methods, more traditional knowledge, in terms of how those things are going to help us moving forward or hinder us?
Yes, I certainly don't think she's anti-technology. I mean, here she is with her cell phone, and also she's able to reach with her views a large audience. It's what the technology, to what use it's put. And also she feels that when there's a policy decision to be made, often the people who are the experts on it, and she points this out, are those who are exploiting the particular, for example, the experts in the forests would be the loggers. The experts in the cement industry would be the ones who mine for limestone. In other words, they don't have a holistic approach.
So it gets us back to what we were talking about in the beginning, which is that it's this kind of myopic, you know, slice of knowledge that, in missing the bigger picture, really sets us on the wrong path. Check out the film's website, VandanaShivaMovie.com, and keep a lookout for when it is available on streaming services. Coming up, I have an interview with urban farmer extraordinaire Nate Looney and with John Rulak, co-founder of Agroforestry Regeneration Communities and executive producer of the film Kiss the Ground. If you have a moment, please leave a positive review for In the Weeds wherever you listen and tell your friends to listen too. Many thanks.